Party, he's using the voters to gain personal power, and he doesn't care if he gets what he wants. As Street adds, now is not the time to fear.
If you're scared of what they're doing, if you're afraid of violence, you wait till after this regime consolidates.
Paul D'Arienzo, New York.
And the previous program was City Watch, and that is heard Thursdays at 5 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly coming up. And while that program is on the air, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 833-922-4692. That's 833-922-4692 or WBAO. Or 833-WBAINYC, 833-WBAINYC. Or, if you're on a computer, buddy.wbai.org. Buddy.wbai.org. That's for people who wants to become a listener sustainer, a.k.a. BAI Buddy. That means that rather than just give one lump sum of money, you can space it out as little as $5 a month, and you can do that as well, too. You got options, people. You got options. All right, 1 minute past 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Agenda Radio coming up.
You're listening to Black Agenda Radio, where we provide news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Margaret Kimberly. In this week's segment, we hear about the Trump administration attempting to force CARICOM member nations to end their participation in a Cuban medical program. The administration is also sending Venezuelan nationals to El Salvador in violation of a court order and of their due process rights. But first, we have an update on conditions in Haiti and the continuing struggle of the people there to end foreign interference in their affairs and regain their sovereignty. You're listening to Black Agenda Radio. I'm Margaret Kimberly. Daoud Andre joins us from COMACODA, the Committee to Mobilize Against Dictatorship in Haiti. He's also the host of Eriti Papadesaline, a daily Haitian community radio program, and the host of Haiti, Our Revolution Continues on WBAI. He joins us from Brooklyn, New York, to discuss current events in Haiti. Thank you, Daoud. Nice to have you back.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you for inviting us to share once again, to share about Haiti with your audience.
We've discussed many times we get incomplete news about Haiti or incorrect news about Haiti. Some of the things I want to touch on as we talk are the gang activity, the news of a hospital that had been burned, immigration, TPS, temporary protective status, which Trump is trying to end. Apparently, there's also a return of cholera. There have been a few cases. So let's start with the gang activity. Remind our viewers who is behind these gangs and tell us about the burning of the hospital.
The gang situation in Haiti, and just about everybody now no longer calls them gangs, calls them rather terrorists, people who are randomly killing innocent people randomly. And these are all poor people that they're killing, people with barely enough to eat in a day, burning down entire neighborhoods, burning down schools. You mentioned the general hospital in Port-au-Prince, and this is a hospital that was completely devastated in the 2010 earthquake and has not been reopened since. A lot of money was put in there to try to get it back going. On December 24th, you had a minister of health who made an attempt to reopen opened the hospital, although it had not been ready. I don't know if you remember, but twice Guy Ikoni, a former prime minister, tried to make a public visit to show that, you know, the government was making progress against the terrorists. And both times there was a shootout. He had to be, you know, he brought out by under gunfire. And that incident on the 24th, that minister of health said this would be the gift of the government to the Haitian people in terms of health, because that's the biggest hospital in the country, the General Hospital in Port-au-Prince. And at that incident, it was a difficult thing because the minister was late. And while he was late, the terrorists attacked the hospital and journalists were killed and injured, and police was also killed in that incident. So it's that same hospital that a couple of months later, the terrorists went again and set fire to. It wasn't open yet, so it was not a functioning hospital. So because it's located in a neighborhood under gang terrorist control. So this week, the big news is Radio Caraibe, 80-year-old institution. Today, practically, can say, not just one of the most popular, but the most popular radio station in Port-au-Prince, because of also it's in an area close to gang terrorist activity. They had moved their operations to another part of the city, but the building was renovated. A very big studio, a theater, was set up inside, and it was set on fire this week by these terrorists. They continued their activities in different parts of the country, of the city, Port-au-Prince, less activity in the Artibonite region. It's in these two departments that they mostly operate. But because of the increased activity by the police and the so-called multinational force against them, although Haitians are very wary of the fact that none of the leaders of these different groups who have organized themselves into something called Vivre Ensemble, which means living together, have been killed. So people are like, you know, are the police really against them? And I should tell you also, in terms of who's controlling them, you know, we know from the words of the U.S. ambassador in Haiti that he communicates with them to coordinate security for his staff. So he says, and he even said, you know, a couple of incidents where the building of the U.S. Embassy was shot at. He said he contacted them to make sure that this was an accident, or were they really trying to shoot at the U.S. Embassy or U.S. Embassy vehicles? So we found that very funny because, you know, the U.S. Embassy call, you shoot at the U.S. Embassy and they call you to find out, did you mean to shoot at us? So Haitians continue to believe that there is collaboration between the U.S. Embassy, the U.S. government, and the gangs. We were surprised to find out about a policy when machine guns, weapons of war, and I have to tell you, they've exhibited some anti-tank weapons, some anti-aerial vehicle weapons, and yet the U.S. Embassy has an agreement with the police, with the Haitian government, puppet Haitian government, that when they retrieve guns, ammunition from these terrorists, that is to be brought to the U.S. Embassy. So the government cannot even use these guns to fight the And they are more armed than the terrorists. There is still today, as we speak, an embargo against the Haitian government buying weapons, either from the U.S. or from countries aligned with the U.S., that is the United Nations, the U.S. government. So this is the difficulty with the gang reality. And the Haitians inside and outside the country, we continue to denounce folks who continue to advocate for these terrorists. It would be interesting to find other people inside or outside of Haiti who speak about these terrorists as though they are revolutionaries, that they are, you know, armed groups fighting to keep their neighborhoods safe. That is garbage. It is propaganda that has nothing to do with the reality. And what we always ask them is how many government officials, let's say they were fighting against the government, how many government officials have these terrorists killed? If you're fighting against the oligarchs, how many oligarchs has Barbecue, Izo, Lamo Sanjou, Vitelom, have they kidnapped? Have they killed any of them? Have they burned the businesses of these oligarchs? Some of them are still functioning in gang neighborhoods. So, and they get a lot of, like, sometimes, not recently, but sometimes you have Barbecue distributing things like pretending to be some sort of Robin Hood that has been given to him by these very same oligarchs. They have even said that they've gotten money support from these oligarchs. So definitely this is not what is going on in Haiti right now.
Thank you so much for giving us that update. I think there's a lot of confusion about Haiti.
I'm sorry, Margaret. I wanted to say, because in the introduction, and I wanted to address that, it's not just misinformation that's happening with Haiti. It's disinformation, because you have, and it's a pattern, you know, it's a pattern from the independence to today, trying to convince the world that we are a bunch of violent people with no capacity to govern ourselves, with no plan of government, with no idea what we want to do with ourselves. And I want to point out, this is a country that is 221 years old, that has been very, very, what can I say, successful in terms of culture, in terms of agricultural production, in terms of governance even, in terms of being a sort of asylum for black people in the early part of our existence of as a country while slavery was still going on. Even after slavery was over in places like the United States, you had African Americans still coming to Haiti for refuge, for a place where they could thrive. Leslie Alexander, she has a book that is called Fear of a Black Republic that I would recommend to the family, where she speaks about the period where African Americans in the United States, they were singing songs about going to Haiti, where they would be treated as human beings, where their children would have no fear of white people, where they would be playing the piano, they would be dancing, where they would be living as human beings. So very different than the common story of failed state from jump that we get from our detractors.
I think most people know that United Nations troops brought cholera to Haiti in 2010.
Yes, yes.
These particular troops were from Nepal, and they dumped their toilets into a river and brought cholera to Haiti, and it's very difficult to eradicate. And apparently there have been cases appearing recently.
As a matter of fact, you're right. This is October 2010. And you know, the funny thing is that as soon as it happened, the people in the Artibonite region, they said, you know, people started to get sick and to die. And the people didn't know what sickness it was. But immediately, the people around the Artibonite River, they were saying that, yeah, this is, we saw these minister people who have a base in the area dump their latrines, portable latrines, in this river. And people use the river to bathe, to wash their clothes, to cook water, to cook their food, you know. And nobody believed them. I have to tell you, even the Haitian community, the Haitian government, there were people that, you know, they would never do that. And of course they did. It was eventually learned, you know, in the laboratories of the world that the strain of cholera that was in Haiti, killing so many Haitians, is the same strain that is in Nepal, and where in within the time frame you had the soldiers who were part of the minister. That was, I have to tell you, some of our numbers say more than 40,000 Haitians were killed, and they talk about a million Haitians who were infected. And the U.S. government at the time said, you know, let's just try to fix this. It doesn't matter where it came from. At the U.N., they said, let's stop discussing where it came from, you know. And eventually, Ban Ki-moon, who was U.N. Secretary General, he offered an apology. Something like, well, you know, a moral, it, you know, it was a moral, it was like an accident that this happened, but it wasn't something that was done in on purpose. He had made some, you know, funny effort to say they're going to raise X amount of hundreds of millions of dollars to compensate the families of the victims, and X amount of hundreds to deal with potable water for the region, for Haiti, you know? And none of it ever happened. Nobody ever got any money, and nobody ever got any Haiti, you know, still the same kind of water situation going on. So it was the Médecins Sans Frontières, who, middle of February, put out an alert to say that, and the Haitian Department of Health also, to say that between February, middle of February and beginning of March, about 150 Haitians were treated for cholera. And in Cité Soleil, this is in Port-au-Prince, there were some, about 20 infections. They said about 70 people have died. The thing is that with the reality of gang activity terrorizing everywhere, every day you hear of another neighborhood. And yesterday, Tuesday, the 18th, there was another, well, on Monday, kind of vehicle, bulletproof vehicle of the U.S.-Kenya mission was burned in Keskov. And yesterday we heard that another Kenyan soldier was severely hurt. They say by helicopter they brought him, but Kenya already lost one. So that's their numbers. So we don't really know how true it is, but they're saying another one yesterday is in grave situation and might die. So when you have a situation like the security, most schools in Port-au-Prince have shut down, and one of the best known institutions in the country, Saint Louis Gonzague, well, a few others had already been said they're not functioning anymore because there's no way really for students to get back and forth from school. And, you know, the government is functioning as if there's nothing going on, as if they can deal with cholera when people can't get to hospitals, as if, you know, they were talking about referendum, as if something, and a referendum for a new constitution, mind you, a puppet government that has no legality, no legitimacy, they said in May, middle of May, they would have a referendum for a new constitution. 2 days ago in the Nouvelliste, which is like the big national newspaper, the head of the Electoral Council provisional electoral council said, you know, there's no way we can organize a referendum in a month and a half. So basically, that shut down. And in November, they had promised that they would have elections for a legitimate government. How do you have an election when people can get from one side of the country to another? They're saying in less than a year, more than a million people in Port-au-Prince have been displaced. And yesterday, neighborhood of Crissoua, was people ran away. So nobody has a fixed address. You know, nobody, I can't say nobody, but majority of the country definitely doesn't have, like, an ID card to be able to register to vote. How are candidates supposed to campaign? You know, the last provisional president, Leslie Voltaire of Famila Valas, he said, you know, while he was in France, he said, well, we will have the election and the referendum in 8 departments, minus the West, where Port-au-Prince is, and the Artibonite region. But Port-au-Prince and Artibonite, this is the bulk. This is about 60% of the electorate. How do you have an election minus 60% of the electorate? So definitely this stuff is not going anywhere.
Let's talk about immigration policy. There are many Haitian people in the U.S. with TPS, temporary protective status, and Trump is pledging to end TPS. Talk to us about that.
So in the Haitian community from the first Trump administration, we gave him a name. The name is Gros Mousseau. Gros Mousseau is like this cartoon character. A big guy who walks around talking loud, talking like a lot of trash. And when people stand up to him, of course, you know, he backs down. So we've never been afraid of Donald Trump. And we say, not just Donald Trump, but bullies get away with what you allow them to get away with. When Trump came to power in 2017, Margaret, the first week, he signed, just like you see all of these things that he's signing, and you realize he doesn't even know what he's signing, you know. He signed to end TPS in 2017, and there were court cases, and some of them are still in court today, believe it or not, from 2017 to today, where he was trying to end TPS immediately and throw everybody out. I don't know if you remember when he said, they made this campaign about racism, about Haitians eating dogs, eating cats, you know. They made this, and he swore that, you know, as soon as he comes in, he's going to get rid of all of them. He's going to throw, there would be no more Haitians in Springfield, Ohio, right? The people in Springfield, the governor of Ohio was like, are you crazy? You know, the economy of this town was revived because of the Haitian labor force. The tax base of Springfield, these are these people who came, and they're never late for work. They don't complain. They're never sick. And of course, Trump knows this better than most about, you know, exploiting undocumented labor. So this is what we're seeing again. He signed, you know, all of these things that he signed. But I have to tell you, yesterday, the 18th of March, Tuesday, the 18th of March, was the second plane deporting, quote-unquote, Haitians that went to Haiti, the Cap-Haïtien airport. The first one was the 4th of February. It had 21 Haitians on there. And of their 21 Haitians, because many of them didn't even have a passport, but 21 black people in there. 12 of them were people who had been convicted for crimes, quote unquote, and 9 of them were related to immigration. Yesterday, the Tuesday, the 18th, was the second plane. So we had 21 on the first plane, and the clown, Elon Musk is dealing with efficiency, with waste, right? So you put 21 Haitians on a plane to go to Haiti. I think that's waste, you know? Yesterday, 46 Haitians, 25, they say, who came from prisons, convicted of crimes to be deported, and stuff that has nothing to do with Trump policy. This is Bill Clinton stuff, you know? And 19 related to immigration. The people of Springfield, the Haitians in Springfield, Ohio, are still in Springfield, Ohio, minus the few who were scared, who self-exiled from Springfield, I guess, who went to another part of the United States where they would be less visible, because people thought that, you know, yeah, he's going to clean up Springfield of Haitians. That's not happened, you know. Last month on the 20th in February, Homeland Security says Noam, she announced that TPS, temporary protected status, for Haitians, which was set to end February 26th, 18 months. It's last July that the Biden administration had authorized TPS. They removed 6 months from the 18 months. It's always 18 months that they give the TPS for. So now TPS for Haitians is set to end in August of 2025. But of course, this is already in court as well. The audience should understand. And we expect, just like all of these things, most of these things, I should say, that he signed, they're in court. Some of them, like the USAID stuff, I don't know if you saw that, but a Judge Chuang reversed him and Elon Musk shutdown of the USAID and firing something like 24,000 employees. And so right now, since yesterday, they've been rehiring these people, putting them on different status. And the thing, everything is in court. What we say to family is, you know, bullies are bullies, and bullies do what bullies do. Racists and wannabe racists, they pander, you know. They say things they think people want to hear. Anyone who thinks that Elon Musk and Trump, they're cleaning up the government to bring more money to your pocket. You know, what is the joke? Is that, let me sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. People who think that they're closing down these agencies so that prices will be lowered, so you'll get better health care, you'll get better education, you'll get more housing. This is not what's going on. Hundreds of billions of dollars that continue to go to, because I haven't heard Elon Musk say the Starlink money he's getting from the government for access in Ukraine, that's part of waste. You know, there was an article about Tesla SUVs are becoming the vehicle that the U.S. government is going to use to transport VIPs around the world. If this is not what they call a conflict of interest, I don't know what is. A racist South African apartheid loving businessman having access to the tax records of every U.S. citizen. If this is not, you know, a problem, so please, people, wake up. What's going on here has nothing to do with better government. It has nothing to do with protecting you, with making your life better. And no, the Democrats are not going to save anyone from Donald Trump and his ilk. The Democrats are not going to protect you. You will have to come out into the streets and take care of that yourself. We are our own liberators. This is the message that not just in the United States, around the world. And no, U.S. policy towards Haiti has not changed. It's about U.S. imperialism. It's about U.S. dominance all over the world. Russia and China will not be saving us either.
And that was Daoud André giving an update on events in Haiti. You're listening to Black Agenda Radio. I'm Margaret Kimberly. Camila Escalante is an editor for Calcitune News and a Latin America correspondent for Press TV. She will discuss the latest Trump administration policy moves in Latin America. Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced that leaders of Caribbean countries will be personally sanctioned if their nations continue to participate in Cuba's program, which sends medical professionals to work around the world. Also, the Trump administration sent more than 200 Venezuelan nationals to Honduras and El Salvador, alleging that they are members of the Tren de Agua group and therefore are threats to national security. Camila Escalante joins us from Toronto. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me again.
So we see this continued obsession with Cuba. We had the Trump administration, the first Trump administration, with just a few days before they left office, announcing that Cuba would be designated a state sponsor of terrorism, which really ratcheted up sanctions and has done great damage to Cuba's economy. Biden comes in a few days later and does not undo that designation until he was about to leave office, and there was a prisoner swap agreement. So Cuba got breathing room for about a week because Trump reinstated that designation. They have cut off Western Union so that people in Cuba, even those with family members who previously were not included in these sanctions, can't send money. Now we have the latest. They want to force nations in the region not to participate in this medical program that sends doctors and nurses all over the world, threatening leaders with personal sanctions, telling them they can't come back to the United States, although so far none have acceded to this demand. So talk to us about the Cuban medical program and why it's so important and why it is a target.
Well, the Caribbean has a really important history with Cuba, going back several decades. You know, the United States tried for a very long time to isolate the Cuban government and people, and the Caribbean decided decades ago that it would establish relations with Havana, and that has been uninterrupted for, as you know, many years, and there have been many important agreements in the area of health and education and other cooperation between these different Caribbean governments and the people and government of Cuba. Obviously, given the constraints of those economies and those small countries, you know, these leaders know that they rely on their partners in the larger economies in the global north to help them with development and with things like disaster mitigation, even in the area of security, and of course with cooperation in the area of tourism that's so important to these economies. And so the U.S. has been taking advantage of that and trying to coerce them in different ways, as of course we've seen the U.S. go to CARICOM and these different individual Caribbean leaders and try to get them to join their agenda when it comes to Haiti and when it comes to other matters. But they thought they could do that. The United States thought they could do that with Cuba, and it really has backfired on them, because since Marco Rubio, the new Secretary of State, since January, came in saying that he would impose visa restrictions over the continued medical cooperation with Cuba, these prime ministers, a great deal of them from the Caribbean, have come out saying that Cuba has been indispensable when it comes to their national health care system. Almost all of the Caribbean governments right now, Caribbean countries, are hosting medical brigades or Cuban medical specialists and personnel in their country, with few exceptions. And they all also benefited from Cuba's help during COVID-19 when these countries didn't have the resources or the expertise to deal with this problem. And so they have stood up and said one by one that they have no intention to suspend that medical cooperation and that they don't agree with the very premise of what's being threatened by Washington, by Marco Rubio and that administration. The administration, Trump's administration, has claimed that there is some sort of exploitative, slave-like condition under which the Cuban medical personnel are working when they go internationally and provide services to different people around the world. In the different speeches that have been given by these prime ministers and at times foreign ministers of the Caribbean, they've said that the Cuban medical personnel present in their country and that have been contracted have been paid on par with their own doctors and specialists in their own country, their own nationals, be it St. Kitts and Nevis, be it Dominica. And so there's no reason to believe that anything exploitative is happening there and that they're getting paid decent wages. They've also gone as far to say as they're going out, you know, in their free time and doing normal people things. They're on their cell phones. They do everything that you would imagine that they would do while abroad. Another one of these weird accusations that has been made is that Cuban doctors get their passports taken away. And that has been, again, that has been pushed back against by these Caribbean leaders. And so they say, some of them have said that if they need to lose their U.S. visas under new, you know, these new threats of visa restrictions against the leaders, then so be it, that it's worth it then rather than have people die who are in line or waiting to or currently receiving life-saving medical care from these Cuban medical specialists. So, you know, this is just another attempt to try to isolate the government of Cuba, as well as we see similar threats against these Caribbean leaders because of the positions they've taken on Venezuela. Keith Rowley, Dr. Keith Rowley, who is now the former prime minister, he's just announced his retirement in Trinidad and Tobago. He's one of the prime ministers that has had a very important role to play in the friendship and sort of upholding the zone of peace in Latin America and the Caribbean when it comes to Cuba and particularly when it comes to Venezuela. He's talked a lot, even in his final days as prime minister, about the importance of Venezuela for energy and for revenue in Trinidad and Tobago and how generous this government of Venezuela has been with Trinidad. And so we're going to see much more of this. It's very important that these Caribbean leaders stand together against the U.S. threats because obviously they can't afford to lose their medical healthcare systems and see them collapse. And also just in the name of solidarity with the people of Cuba, who even this week are going through such a difficult time with the power outages and all of the different issues that are, of course, caused by the decades-long blockade on Cuba. And the people of the Caribbean know that, particularly the people who've gone and lived in Cuba, and they themselves have benefited from Cuban higher education.
You pointed out, you just mentioned the blackouts that have been happening periodically for the last year that are a result of the sanctions that existed since the early 60s were bad enough, but placing Cuba on this list of state sponsors of terror has been truly devastating to that country. It even impacts tourism. European tourists who often went to Cuba, once that designation was made, that meant they could not visit the United States if they entered Cuba. So we have an administration that is determined not just to punish Cuba, but to try to end the revolution and end the socialist project in Cuba. But my question is the Cuban revolution in danger of being destroyed by the U.S.?
Well, I think the United States right now today represents destruction. And obviously, everyone knows that it's an empire that is in very swift decline and that its only recourse is to turn to terrorism, to turn to violence and to attack those that are vulnerable around it. And Cuba is just off the shores of Florida. And it is a country that is just absolutely being suffocated and strangled year after year. We've seen more of these blackout events that have been impacting large parts of the island, including the one this week. And that, you know, poses a really, you know, obvious big threat to a country that already has so much difficulty in so many areas. And so I think that the people of Cuba are extraordinarily resilient, having been born into these sorts of conditions and having lived through the different waves of the sanctions and the ways in which they've been impacted by that. And so they'll continue. Obviously, there's a lot of outpouring of support. There's a lot of attention that has been given to Cuba as things have worsened from the United States and from people who have sought to pull together resources and solidarity to ensure that their hospitals and medical facilities have the most minimum necessary medicines and supplies that are required for their system to run. But it is very difficult. It's just impossible to say otherwise. But right now, I think it's important to say that there are people from all over the world in Havana this week who are participating in the Colloquium Patria, which is an event which talks about AI, which talks about they have speakers and panels who are discussing media, alternative media, ways of communicating to combat fascism and the rise of the far right. They have people from West Asia, from East Asia, from Africa, from the Caribbean and the rest of Latin America and North America and Europe as well. And so it's really important that we stay engaged in that. And I wouldn't go as far as to say that the revolution is in danger, but it is under constant and permanent threat by the U.S., particularly under this administration and Marco Rubio.
Mr. Rubio is the Cuban ancestry of family of people who call themselves exiles, who are so dedicated to damaging, to even destroying the revolution, that they are willing to cause great suffering to the Cuban people who are still there. So it is a supreme irony that this group so close to Cuba, many like Mr. Rubio in Florida, who are literally physically so close to Cuba and so determined, so committed to destroy the revolution, that they have caused great suffering for the people who they claim to be concerned about. So that is an irony, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And if there's one thing that people of the U.S. should know, it's that it truly is very difficult to live under these sanctions, these unilateral coercive measures, which are absolutely illegal, that are imposed by the United States government, which the rest of the world categorically disagrees with, which they vote for usually every start of November annually at the UN General Assembly, the resolution against the decades-long blockade on Cuba. And it creates the most difficult situation economically, but also in other areas. Like it harms culture. It harms the ability of Cubans to produce rap music, hip-hop, to be able to have recording studios, to be able to have the minimum supplies, to be able to do art. Absolutely everything is harmed under this. And it's something that is exclusive from the United States imposed on the people of Cuba. And so it really is something that, you know, I think that everybody should get involved in if they can find a way through the various different solidarity groups with Cuba and through pooling resources to send donations to the island, because it really makes an impact. These people in Florida are extremists. They have very extreme positions with regards to all of Latin America, but specifically they're looking to increasingly strangle Cuba, and they're exerting disproportionate influence on Washington and the central decision-making people in the United States. All of that is coming from people who are very much aligned with or in support of actual terrorists who carried out acts of terrorism against Cuba and the Cuban people and the revolutionary leaders over the years. So these are people who should not be trusted to govern over United States foreign policy, over Latin America, and particularly over Cuba. So I really hope that those sorts of efforts to send medical supplies and medicines to Cuba continue.
Let's talk about U.S. policy towards Venezuela. You have a similar situation where these unilateral coercive measures, sanctions, have done great damage to Venezuela, prevented Venezuela, an oil-producing nation, from even selling its product. And, of course, that means people leave Venezuela in an effort to escape these conditions that are created by the U.S. So there have been many Venezuelans in coming to the U.S. in the past few years. But the Trump administration has decided to make an example of them, pushing his policy of mass deportations. The administration sent more than 200 Venezuelans in violation of an order from a federal judge who ordered them not to be removed until he could hold a hearing. The administration sent them anyway, some to Honduras and to El Salvador. They've made a great show of the men sent to El Salvador, to this prison that they keep bragging about, CECOT prison. The president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, brags about it. He has even said that the U.S. could send U.S. citizen prisoners to El Salvador. The Trump administration had previously made repatriation agreements with Venezuela, but now they have decided to make this big show of sending Venezuelans to El Salvador, alleging them to be members of a criminal organization called Tren de Agua, without any proof, by the way. So talk to us about this situation.
Well, what happened a few weeks ago was that Venezuelan migrants were deported and they were going to be taken to, or they were taken to, Guantanamo Bay, the occupied territory of Cuba, and they were to be put in that prison. That, of course, is something that the United States has been propagandizing about, how dangerous criminals and terrorists who are non-citizens would be sent there. Through a deal in negotiations with Caracas, they were able to secure the transfer of those Venezuelans back home to Venezuela. And they did that through a transfer that went through Honduras. So there should not be any Venezuelan migrants right now in Honduras. And then, of course, what happened over the weekend was that a number of Venezuelans, many who were picked up at different times, and some of them who were waiting for deportation proceedings or court dates, or they were sent to El Salvador to be at the CECOT, which is the maximum security prison for terrorism in El Salvador, which is a 40,000 person facility, which was opened just a couple of years ago. These people all came from different, let's say, backgrounds. They were living in different parts of the United States. We have heard over the last few days the stories of many of these Venezuelan migrants. Some of them were, you know, they're making the headlines in Venezuela. One of them was a composer, a Venezuelan musician. He's 32 years old. He had just been going to the United States to try to continue his musical career. He was up and coming. He had nothing to do with gangs. He just had tattoos. That's what many of these family members have said. They even told these detained Venezuelans when they were incarcerated, as far as their lawyers and family members know, that they were specifically told that they were being held because of their tattoos. Another person was a Venezuelan barber that was unjustly arrested and deported and is now at the CECOT. And there are many other people. Yesterday, Causacha News, our correspondent, Michaela Olivar, was in Caracas when they held a big march. A lot of Venezuelan grassroots organizations and Chavista organizations, but also the family members, relatives of people who were sent to El Salvador. They all found out in different ways, because some of them said that they saw that their loved ones had been sent to El Salvador because they recognized them on social media. But some of the people who were put on that plane and sent to El Salvador, they were told that they were going to be deported to Venezuela. And then they arrived on Salvadoran soil. So family members have been trying to scrape together information and find out their whereabouts. If you really look at what took place, it is in all ways a sequester. It's a kidnapping. These people thought that they would be able to work out their own self-deportation, voluntary deportation, by which, you know, a family member would be able to purchase a ticket for them to get on a flight and go back to their home country on their own, or that they would just be deported in some way, you know, on some sort of flight back to Venezuela. They had no idea that they were going to be taken to a third country, and a country which right now has been accused for many months of, you know, human rights violations in that prison cell and in the country in general, where people have been rounded up for their human rights activism, for their environmental activism, and people have been accused of being gang members in El Salvador who also have nothing to do with El Salvador. It's a country that is in a permanent ongoing state of exception where there's widespread human rights abuses. And so this is something, this agreement to use El Salvador's prison to house people who are accused of terrorism under this proclamation by President Trump, is something that has been in the works for a very long time, clearly. During the last couple of years, we saw many Republican lawmakers, as well as people like Eric Prince, who was the founder of Blackwater, and then also Elon Musk and many others, went and met with Nayib Bukele in San Salvador. And they have been preparing for this Trump administration and the sorts of deals that would take place between El Salvador and the United States. It's something that they've thought out for a very long time. And it's a model that they could actually export to different countries. For example, there's a far-right president who is attempting to stay in power right now in Ecuador, which goes to elections next month, which has also tried to implement the same sort of Nayib Bukele El Salvador model in Ecuador, and which he has a very strong relationship with the United States as well. But it's important to say that people, you know, since the opening of this SECOT, this maximum security prison, have said that this is essentially, it's a concentration camp that is supposed to just round up tens of thousands of people, making El Salvador the country with the highest incarceration rate, just like the United States. And all of the people who will be imprisoned there are children of the poor, are people who are going to be exploited and who are going to be put to slave labor. And now they're not only subjecting their own people to that, but also participating in these severe human rights violations against foreigners without due process in a country without rule of law, coming from the United States, where there's no rule of law, no due process. And so the government of Venezuela has said that they will work intensely with all instances internationally and organizations and negotiate with the United States government to try to bring these people back to Venezuela, who the Venezuelan government says have not committed any demonstrable or evidenced crime. They are simply being held because of their nationality. They're simply being held on what's very much, you know, a very racist premise that is singling out people because of their nationality. And in other cases, the U.S., you know, is poised to do that against people based on just their appearance of nationality. And we know that the ways in which these sorts of far-right campaigns have targeted Haitians and other people from other countries and have tried to tie them to criminal organizations, terrorism, and everything else.
This case is very disturbing because, as I said, a federal judge instructed the administration not to take these people out of the country. They did anyway. They're refusing to answer questions. The judge required the Department of Justice and Homeland Security to meet in his chambers today. We're speaking on March 19th. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens. This was not legal. As you said, these folks do not have due process, but it's legal if no one stands up to them. And this constitutional crisis we've been hearing so much about is evident in this case and others, where the Trump administration violates orders from judges in this country. And there are, lest we forget, three branches of government in the U.S. Trump is not a king, nor is any other U.S. president. But that's what happens when we have the continuation of these imperialist policies, and countries in the region are either puppets like El Salvador, or they're punished like Cuba and Venezuela if they don't comply.
Right. And so the demand of the Venezuelan government and the families of the people who have been disappeared now and transferred to Venezuela is that they be returned to Venezuela. It's that if they have committed any crime, that they stand before a Venezuelan court and face consequences for whatever crime they committed, at the very least be tried in the United States, but not transferred to a third country. It's important to say as well that the Venezuelan government has been working earnestly for many months now to try to eradicate the Tren de Aragua, this criminal organization, in their own territory. And it's a constant battle when a country like Venezuela borders countries like Brazil and Colombia that also have their share of problems when it comes to transnational criminal organizations, and they're trying to protect very large borders. And so this is an issue that the government of Venezuela has taken on, and they are committed to eradicating these criminal organizations, and I think they would, you know, process them themselves back in their country. And so that's what they're demanding right now, is to release those people from El Salvador, where we don't even know the names. We haven't been presented with any sort of list or register to who is there, the names of the people, what they're being accused of or what they've been charged with or found to have been doing or anything like that, to be able to sort through that information. So it's absolutely more of this sort of breakdown of international law that's being led by the United States.
And that was Camila Escalante discussing Trump administration efforts to force CARICOM member nations to end their participation in Cuba's medical program, and the Trump administration violation of a court order and of constitutionally guaranteed due process rights in sending Venezuelan nationals to El Salvador.
Thank you for joining this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue every Wednesday.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl.
On Saturday, March 22nd, from 11:30 a.m. to 3 p.m., the producers of What's Happening, Haiti, Our Revolution Continues, and Speaking Truth to Power will celebrate what would have been Ralph Pointer's 91st birthday. In a fundraiser for WBAI and elder political prisoners, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Iman Jamil Alamin, formerly H-Rap Brown, and Kamal Siddiqui will be at St. Mark's in the Bowery, 131 East 10th Street, near 2nd Avenue. We'll provide music, poetry, inspirational speakers, and refreshments, and ask you to be generous to WBAI. Details are at Eventbrite under Pointer, and Pointer is spelled P-O-Y-N-T-E-R. Or call 917-603-6160.
This is Bedavit Desai, Executive Director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, with great news for all qualifying Uber and Lyft drivers who drove from 2014 to 2017. Under the terms of a settlement by Attorney General Letitia James and Uber, as well as Lyft, you may have money coming to you from a $328 million wage theft case. But time is running out, with a March 31st deadline fast approaching. Over 60,000 drivers have already received their money. NITWA is making a final push for 30,000 remaining drivers to file by the end of this month. It does not matter if the driver is no longer working for Uber or Lyft, was previously fired by them, or has moved out of the country. If the driver has passed away, the surviving family member can file to receive the monies. Please come to our union office, 31-10 37th Avenue, Long Island City, Queens, New York, 11101. We are open Sunday to Friday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. We can help you file for free. Everything is confidential. That's 31-10 37th Avenue, Long Island City in Queens. Our phone number is 718-706-9892. Again, that's 718-706-9892. This is Beta V Desai, Executive Director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance.
I'm Rebecca Miles, and I'll be hosting a new show called Frontline Voices, which will air Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays at 12 noon. We'll both feature interviews with prominent journalists, investigative reporters, professors, and activists in our neighborhoods. So join me.
All right, and the previous program was Black Agenda Radio with